Jeffrey Stone is author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, and we left off discussing the Sedition Act of 1798. Now, let's turn to the first person, and we'll only get to the first person ever indicted under it, that being a man named Matthew, I'm assuming it's Lyon.
I think probably you're right, but Lyon is probably the way we today would pronounce it.
Tell us a little bit about why Matthew Lyon was basically made an example of. I mean, someone needed to be indicted under it to see if the law actually worked or could be applied. So tell us how and why it became to be him.
Well, he was a very interesting and controversial figure. He was an immigrant who was, when he first came to the United States, an indentured servant. It's kind of a backwoods character, very entrepreneurial, very much a man of the people. He ran for Congress in the first couple of elections in Vermont, was defeated, finally was elected, went to Congress, and was clearly an affront to the Federalists, who were basically much more upper crust and viewed themselves as highly civilized, whereas Matthew Lyon was really a person from the backwoods. And he had a number of altercations with members of Congress, including one where he spit in the face of a Federalist who had insulted his military record. They ultimately later wound up in a fistfight on the floor of the House of Representatives. Lyon was a good first target for the Federalist, and so as soon as the Sedition Act was enacted, he was the one they initially went after. He always spoke his mind very directly, and he criticized John Adams and his administration in sharp terms as essentially an administration that was more concerned with pomp and adulation and foolishness than was really doing the public's business. And for making that statement, he was prosecuted and convicted by a hand-picked Federalist jury in Vermont and sentenced to jail for a period of 4 months. While in jail, Lyon ran for re-election in the election of 1798 and was elected. That was extremely frustrating to the Federalists to have taken this particular example of what they regarded as uncouth and ungenteel republicanism to have successfully prosecuted and convicted him and then have him be re-elected from prison. So he was one of 14 people who were prosecuted under the Sedition Act. As I said earlier, all of them were members of Jefferson's Republican Party. Most of them were editors. The judges were ruthless in their efforts to secure convictions. All the judges were Federalists. As I said, also, they handpicked the jurors. And the main effort was to put out of business those who would criticize the Adams administration. It backfired. One of the interesting things about the Sedition Act is that the American people were very upset with it. And in the election of 1800, in fact, what they did is exactly the opposite of what the Federalists had intended. They gave Jefferson and the Republicans a victory, in part because of their upset over the heavy-handedness of the Sedition Act, and that led eventually to the demise of the Federalist Party.
On President Adams' last day in office, the Sedition Act also expired. Thomas Jefferson becomes president March 1801, and he pardons all of those convicted under the Sedition Act. Unfortunately, it took another four decades for Congress to actually deal with the issue of reparations to descendants of those convicts, but Congress did eventually pony up and pay back all the fines with interest.
And did declare that the Sedition Act was a violation of the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court of the United States has never missed an opportunity since then to make clear that the Sedition Act of 1798 is the quintessential violation of the First Amendment, because what it made criminal was criticism of the government.
Yeah, the Sedition Act was referred to as a mistaken exercise and was also declared null and void.
Correct.
Just as a last part of this piece of our conversation, can you discuss what the Supreme Court wrote in 1794, quoting, "Under the First Amendment, there is no such thing as a false idea."
Okay, you mean 1964.
Oh,
you my said
mistake.
1794.
Right.
Yeah, 1964. That was in New York Times versus, I'm sorry, that was in the Gertz case, in which the Supreme Court declared that under the First Amendment, the government may not declare any idea to be false. And what was critical about that, it was a recognition of what I called the first principle that we talked about earlier, that the government may not exercise a form of paternalism and decide that certain ideas are bad or undesirable or false, and for that reason alone to declare them inappropriate for public debate. And the court's declaration in the Gertz case, that there's no such thing as a false idea, recognized that point unequivocally. And that's really a centerpiece of the entire doctrine that surrounds the First Amendment. The notion that you can get up and you can say that homosexuality is not immoral, or that women should have the right to vote, or that slavery should be ended, or that gays should be allowed to marry, all views that at various times in our history would have been regarded as odious and as anathema, but which at various times and to different degrees have come to be accepted by either all people or most people as a result of the fact that they were allowed to continue to deliberate and to discuss and debate these ideas, and the government was not allowed to simply prohibit their articulation.
You note in the book that the impact of the Sedition Act was such that the U.S. government, for basically 55 or 60 years or so, really didn't do anything active to try and silence criticism. But that changed with Abraham Lincoln in office and the Civil War underway. There actually was no legislation. And I find this to be very interesting. The Civil War era is the only one mentioned in your book where there was not an active effort by the U.S. government to silence dissent. Now, granted, the Civil War was also the only era in which habeas corpus had been suspended, and there's legal questions about was that correct, but this was a time where there was no actual legislative effort to silence dissent. So let's look at how Abraham Lincoln made use of his powers to have the same effect as the Sedition Act. How did that come about?
First off, it's important to understand what it means to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. What the writ of habeas corpus does, and the reason why it's regarded as such a bulwark of democracy, is that if a government official arrests you, seizes you, and locks you up, the writ gives you or your representative the right to go to a court and to ask the court to determine whether the government has a lawful justification for your detention. If the court finds that the government does not have a lawful right to detain you, then it will order your release. Suspending the writ of habeas corpus is therefore an extraordinary act, because what it essentially means is that executive or military officials can seize an individual on whatever basis they choose, lock them up, and if you or your representative goes to court and says, they're holding me without adequate justification, the court will say, sorry, we have no jurisdiction to hear this because the writ of habeas corpus has been suspended. The Constitution authorizes suspension of the writ of habeas corpus in cases of rebellion or invasion. And, of course, the Civil War was a rebellion. But even then, under only very specified and narrowly defined circumstances. Lincoln first suspended the writ early in the war, shortly after Fort Sumter, when Union troops were trying to get through Baltimore to reach the nation's capital in order to protect it against a possible Southern secessionist invasion. And they were blocked in their effort to do so by secessionist sympathizers in Baltimore. And Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus because the local police in Maryland were either disloyal to the Union or, in any event, they were inadequate to deal with the mobs. So that authorized the federal military officials to arrest individuals who were obstructing their access through the city and to lock them up in military detention facilities without any opportunity to go to court to seek review. During the course of the war, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus on 7 additional occasions, and they were broader and broader in terms of covering most of the North by the time the war was over. Under those suspensions, it meant that military officials who were given certain governing powers throughout the United States did have the authority to seize individuals in this manner. Most of the people who were seized were people suspected of desertion or avoiding the draft or engaging in various kinds of espionage or sabotage. But in more than a few instances, there were also individuals who were detained simply because they criticized the government, Lincoln, the military authorities, the suspensions of the writ of habeas corpus, Emancipation Proclamation, and so on. Lincoln's own view on these activities was quite interesting. He himself never actually called for the arrest of any person because of his expression. He never directly ordered any person to be arrested. And for the most part, he regarded the arrests of individuals by military officials when the basis for the arrest was speech as unwarranted and a problem and something that he regretted. To his credit, he was thoughtful about this issue and did not believe that the government should be acting in the way it did during the Sedition Act controversy. On the other hand, Lincoln can clearly be faulted for not having taken a more decisive stand in ordering his generals essentially to knock it off. There were specific instances during the course of the war when he was very upset with the actions of his generals and did, in fact, order them not to arrest anyone else because of their speech. But for the most part, he tended to give them a relatively free rein and did not want to undercut them publicly if he could avoid doing so. And therefore, there were many people who were arrested in these circumstances. Usually, they were very brief arrests, and they were released fairly quickly. There were about 300 newspapers that were shut down around the country for brief periods of time by military officials. But I think it's fair to say that Lincoln's approach to all of this was quite different from that of the Federalists in 1798. He did not think that it was a good idea to be restricting speech. He was subjected to more vitriolic criticism than any president in American history, either before or after. And for the most part, he tolerated that in good grace and without a sense of anger or political manipulation.
You're listening to Jeffrey Stone, author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. We'll be back with him after another short break.